All right, great to see everybody today. My name is John, and we're continuing, as Pastor Chris said, we're continuing through the I Am statements. And what I've seen through all of the I Am statements is that they reveal a couple things. They reveal many things, but what I noticed specifically is that they reveal two things, one thing about Jesus and then one thing about us. The first thing it reveals is that we have a need. He lists that need and kind of posits himself as the sufficiency to that need. The second thing that it reveals is that the attribute that he has overwhelms and sustains that very need that we have. And so when you see any of the I Am statements, he says, I am this or that, and he's kind of inferring that we are not that, and we need that. And so what we really need is not only the thing that Jesus gives, but more importantly, who Jesus is. When Jesus says, I am the bread of life, or I am the door, or I am the light, he's inferring that nothing else can compete in meeting that need that we have. So he reveals the need that we have, and he reveals that it meets that need totally. He alone is the source and the fountain of meeting those pressing needs that we have. Just think about it. He says, I am the bread. What is the need that we have? We're starving. We literally, spiritually are starving. And only he can sustain us and satisfy that. He says, I am the light. Why does he say that? Because we're blind and we're groping around in darkness. And only he can be our vision. He says, I am the good shepherd. What does that tell us about us? It means we're lost. We are lost. We don't know which way to go except that he comes along and directs our life. He said, I am the gate, or I am the door, because we are locked out. We don't have access to heaven except and through him. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. Why? Because we're dead. You see, each statement reveals something about us and it reveals something about him. He says, in 2 weeks, we're going to study, I am the vine. Why? Because we're powerless. We have no power aside of being plugged in to him. And so he says, here is what it reveals about you, and here is what it reveals about me. And the crazy thing is all humans inherently believe we are not starving, blind, lost, locked out, dead, and powerless. And even Christians can believe that too. Christians can believe, oh man, the Lord is just really, you know, he is doing a work in my life. And in Revelation chapter 3, verse 17, Jesus is talking to the church of Laodicea, to a group of Christians, and he says, you guys forgot where you came from. He says, you say I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, poor, pitiable, blind, and naked. And so even us as Christians, we forget that we starve without him sustaining us, that we're blind without him giving us vision. And Jesus tells us these things about himself, because either we don't know them on our own or we have refused to know them in certain ways. He's revealing something about him because we are desperate to know it. And he's excited to reveal and dispel that ignorance and blindness of our own minds. He really wants you to see who he is. He doesn't want to just give you what you need in this moment. He wants to take and have us realize that it's not just the bread that we need, it's him. And he delights being made known to his kids. When Roman was younger, I took him rock climbing. I loved to rock climb, at least I used to when I was younger. And I took him rock climbing. He wasn't really thrilled at it at that point. I think it was about 2 months old when he was 2 months old when I first took him, but no, he was older than that. But I wanted him to know who I was, this little part of my life that I have this great joy in. And, you know, someday I'll take him mountain biking, and I get to take Olivia maybe next year to Mexico. And we love sharing our lives with our kids. We want them to know how much we love them. We want them to know how much we care for them and want to provide for them. And this is the heart of the Father as he reveals Jesus through these I am statements. He wants you to know who he is, and he delights to show you who he is. And so I would encourage, as we go through these things, and as we have, listen to him, explore him, investigate Jesus on your own, find out who he is. Spurgeon said, all the titles of our Lord are names of power. They express his nature, his perfection, and his prerogatives. What they declare, he is. And so he is telling you, he's telling me, he's telling us today who he is to prevent us from doing a number of things probably, but I've written down four of them just for us to look at. So he sets this thing up where he says, I am this. And it tells us about us, it tells us about him, and he tells us that to prevent us from doing four things, at least four that we're going to look at. He wants to prevent us from remaining ignorant of the need. Well, John, how do you remain ignorant of the fact that you need daily bread? Well, I know in my life there's days that I wake up and I do not understand fully my great need for him to supply what I need for that day. I'll just go through the day and not turn my heart and my mind to him and go, Jesus, I need you to sustain me. Or sometimes we think about him being the vine. Sometimes there's days where I'll just go, I'll power through this, Lord. I'll put my head down, and I ignore or I remain ignorant or I forget about my lack of power outside of him. He also wants to prevent us from attempting to meet that need somewhere else or in someone else or in something else. How often we can find ourselves, believers or non-believers, attempting to, we might see or perceive these needs in our lives and then attempt to meet them in something else other than Jesus Christ. And so he wants to say, I am the bread of life, or I am the door. There's no confusion there. The third thing he wants to prevent us from doing is denying that there is a need. Some of us forget. Some of us just will deny it. The fourth thing is believing. He wants to prevent us from believing that he doesn't see or know your needs. Today, we're going to look at the phrase that he says, I am the resurrection and life. But just think about some of the other things that Jesus said. He wants you to know that he sees your needs. He wants you to know that he understands those needs, and so he tells you emphatically, I am this for you. Jesus knows your greatest need this morning. And sometimes we're not aware of those needs. But he's revealing himself to you through the Bible that he alone is the fulfillment and the resolution of that deep need in an ultimate sense. There's nothing else that can compete with what Jesus says when he says, I am. And this isn't something new that Jesus started in the New Testament. It's been going on since the Old Testament. Each Sunday that we've heard Jesus say, I am, it throws us back to Exodus chapter 3, where God said to Moses at the burning bush, I am that I am. As Richard taught last week, that same passage also tells us that God's name is Yahweh or Jehovah. And interestingly, even in the Old Testament, similar to the New Testament, God was revealing who he was and what his children's needs were back then too. He wanted them to know who he was and what their needs were. Like, think of the word Jehovah Jireh, I will provide, the God that provides. He said, I see my children, they need provision. And that was specifically to Abraham when he was about to sacrifice his son Isaac. And there in the thicket, he sees the ram. And he says, Jehovah Jireh, the Lord provides. He saw the need, and then God expresses himself through his name, is I am not only going to meet that need, but I am that. Jehovah Rapha, the healer. Again, we need healing. He expresses himself as the consummate fulfillment of that need. El Ra'i. You remember Hagar, who was in the desert, having taken her son Ishmael out in the desert, having been kicked out of the home. And she thought she was going to die of thirst in the desert. And God says to her, I see you. El Ra'i, meaning the Lord that sees, the God that sees. And so we jump into this knowing that God has always wanted to reveal himself to you and to me and to people on earth. And he's always done that in a way that shows us our need as well as him meeting that need. So let's pick it up in John chapter 11 to get a little context of this I am statement. We're going to read John chapter 11, verse 1 through 16. We got to get through a few verses here, so put your seatbelts on. I'm going to try to read it quickly. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. You can see that Jesus was really connected to this family. They loved him. He loved them. They knew them well. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha, and it's interesting, before we get into that, it's interesting that this next verse seems a little bit disconnected from verse 6. It's almost like, as you read through it, John was like, hey, I'm going to say this in verse 5 so that verse 6, you don't get confused by verse 6 almost. Because verse 5 says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Okay, great. Verse 6, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Wait, what a second. Why would he stay later there if he knew that Lazarus needed to be healed? But verse 5 squashes any kind of question in that. Verse 7, then after this, he said to his disciples, let us go to Judea again. And the disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you are going there again? You can imagine the disciples, I was thinking about it, they're like, Jesus, they had rocks in their hands, and they were going to throw them at us to the point that we didn't live anymore. Why would you want to ever go back there? They're not nice people. They throw rocks at us. And I remember when I was a kid at church camp one time. This is back in Pennsylvania, not the same church camp we just went to, but although we love that church camp. And I was standing there talking to a friend. I think I was about 10 years old. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a rock hits my head, and I fall to the ground. And I get up, and I am so mad. And that rock was like this. And I looked over, and we figured out some kid had just been throwing rocks like, I don't know, 20 yards away, 30 yards, just thinking that he's just throwing rocks. Well, one of them hit me right in the head. And well, think about these guys want to track these other guys down and throw rocks at them. It sounds like a pretty rocky time. Oh, I thought of that last service. But the disciples are going, Jesus, we just left there. We escaped with our lives. Don't send us back there. They have rocks. In verse 9, Jesus answered and said, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. Verse 10, but if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. What Jesus is saying is, let's go. We have a job to do. I'm doing the Father's will, and we will accomplish the Father's will. Don't worry about the rocks. Verse 11, after saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. And the disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he'll recover. Verse 13, now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought that he meant taking rest and sleep. Verse 14, then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. And then Thomas, I love this verse, verse 16. So Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. I'm thinking, just to myself, was Thomas still thinking about the guys with the rocks? He was like, oh, whatever. We'll just go. We're going to get stoned anyway. So let's go and die with Lazarus. But nonetheless, verse 17. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Why 4 days? Well, there was the day for the messenger to come up to Jesus. There was 2 days of waiting, and there was a day for the group to come back down. And so he had been in the tomb for 4 days. And some of the commentators said that perhaps Jesus waited that long so that there was no question that Lazarus was really, really dead. The King James tells us that he stinketh. He had started to decompose. Rigor mortis had come and gone, and his body at that time would have been literally seeping out fluids. It would have been a mess. This Jews at that time, there was groups of Jews that also had superstitions, of course not accurate or true, but had superstitions that the spirit which left the body would at times come back to attempt to enter the body again for 3 days. So for whatever the reason, in one sense, he waited 4 days. But then in another sense, he tells us why he waited 4 days. Jesus wants to reveal the glory of God to Mary, Martha, and all the Jews there, and to us. And it's because of his intense love and his perfect love for this little family in Bethany that he waits and delays the one-day trip to them. Wait a second. How does that make sense? Listen, the reason Jesus did not go to Lazarus when he heard he was sick was because he loved him and his sisters, Mary and Martha. He would stay where he was and let Lazarus die because he loved them. Verse 5 and 6, read it with me again. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so, or in another translation, therefore, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. It was love that caused Jesus to delay. How does that make sense? In other words, it was more loving to put Lazarus through death and his sisters through grief, if that would reveal more of God's glory to them and more of the glory of Christ. Jesus loves us by showing us himself. He loves us so much, we got to remember that he does not mainly love us in this life by sparing us from suffering and death. He mainly loves us by showing us and giving us himself and his glory. That is so contradictory to the way we would want things naturally or think about things naturally. We cannot, you cannot, I cannot measure God's love by how much health and wealth and comfort he brings into our lives or to your life or to my life. If that were the measure of God's love, he would have surely hated Paul, the apostle. Measure God's love for you by how much of himself he shows you. How much of himself he gives to you to know and enjoy. And gang, we don't see Jesus like we see him in suffering. And so Jesus was willing to love this group, this little family enough to bring them to this dark hour so that he could show himself to them who he really was. In John 14, 21, Jesus says, whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he is who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father. And listen, I will love him and I will manifest myself to him. What a wonderful statement. I will love you and manifest myself to you. That's how I will show my love to you. In times of suffering and trials and loss, just think of these sisters. Think of the brokenness of this world. Think of the family at the Creation Fest, the families in Reading. People sitting in this sanctuary right now have suffered loss, are going through things, or will go through things. And in the dark days, when it seems that there was no hope and no answers, there's been disappointments, rejection, heartache. Jesus loves us. Not first by taking away the suffering or the loss or the darkness or giving answers, but by first giving us himself in ways that could not have been ours without this painful season. If you demand that God love you the way the world expects to be loved in this life, you won't know what it really means to be loved by God. The love of God is the gift of his glorious self. It's just floors me that it's true, but because he loved Jesus and Mary and Martha, he stayed 2 days longer and let them walk through the valley of the shadow of death and then went and showed him his glory. Picking it up again in verses 18 and 19, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, verse 19, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. William Barclay, as Richard has pointed out so many times, does a great job on the social and cultural context of ancient Jewish circumstances. And so I'm quoting him as I read this. He says, "In the house of mourning there were set customs. So long as the body was in the house, it was forbidden to eat meat or to drink wine, to wear phylacteries, those things that they tied on their wrists and on their forehead, or to engage in any kind of study. No food was to be prepared in the house, and such food as was eaten must not be eaten in the presence of the dead. And as soon as the body was carried out, all the furniture was reversed, and the mourners sat on the ground or on low stools. On the return from the tomb, a meal was served which had been prepared by the friends of the family. It consisted of bread, hard-boiled eggs, and lentils. And the round eggs and the lentils symbolized life, which was always rolling to death. The deep mourning lasted for 7 days, of which the first three were days of weeping. During these 7 days, it was forbidden to anoint oneself, even to put on one's shoes, to engage in any kind of duty or business, or even to wash. And the week of deep mourning was followed by 30 days of lighter mourning." So that's the context. I would have no idea about that. But that's the context that we're told Jesus was walking into during this time. And it seems that this was a fairly prominent family in that time, or a wealthy family, as so many people had traveled from Jerusalem to this unknown little town of Bethany to be here for this man's funeral. In the next few verses, we're going to see multiple responses to this situation. We're going to see how the effect of human physical death impacts God as well as mankind. In addition to that, and more central to this study, we're going to learn about who Jesus is and how that meets our deepest and greatest need. Verse 20 and 21. "So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house." Isn't that true to form of what we know in Martha and Mary? Martha was always the one that was going to charge ahead, and Mary was often the one that would just sit at Jesus' feet or stay seated there. And like the explanation that William gave us, she was probably seated on a low stool or on the floor. Verse 21 says, "Martha said to Jesus," and this is the first recorded response. She says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Her response is similar to most humanity when dealing with great loss and suffering. In fact, Mary and Martha asked the exact same question. And in a way, so do the Jews. The question underneath that statement is, why did you let this happen? Why didn't you do something? Why didn't you? I know you can stop this. Why didn't you stop this? Anger, grief, disappointment, questions, gang. These are all a part of our life in this world. All of us, every single person has these things going on in their life to varying degrees in different seasons. These are all a part of loss and suffering and sickness, accidents, breakups, heartaches, divorces, unmet expectations, rejection, and it's real and it's okay. You see, Lazarus was dead. Something happened that they hadn't planned for and didn't want to happen. And grief had invaded a once happy home. We all have these things going on. One whom they had loved so dearly was snatched from their presence, and they were devastated. And death is an ugly thing. The consequences of sin is an ugly thing. And when I say consequences of sin, I'm not referencing that Lazarus did something, but that death in and of itself is a consequence of sin. It was never meant to be here. It invades our home. And with it comes at times division, discouragement, disillusionment, and defeat. When someone literally dies, we're ripped apart. And there's other deaths that happen too. There's other heartaches other than just literal, like what we're reading here, physical death, that bring disillusionment in our lives to families and to ministries and to lives. This is not unknown from us as human beings. Yet Martha, in the next verse, voices a bit of faith. She says in verse 22, "But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give it to you." Both sisters went to Jesus. We're going to read about Mary in just a little bit. In the midst of their mourning and grief and disappointment. Yeah, they had questions. Don't you have questions? It's okay to have questions. But they went to Jesus with those questions. Mary had to be called. We'll read in a little bit. Martha ran. She was always charging ahead. And as much as Jesus offers consolation and comfort in these moments, which he does, and we thank Jesus for his comfort. 1 Corinthians tells us that he's the God of all comfort. But here, this is not, consolation is not the point here. He cuts to the chase and offers resurrection and life. Instead of just putting his arm around these gals and questioning like how this happened, or perhaps even demonizing Adam and Eve and just going, oh, I can't believe that Adam, that he would bring this into this situation. How often as human beings do we look around to point to something that's causing our pain, causing our frustration, causing confusion or whatever, and we're looking for something to point out. And Jesus says, don't look around. I want you to look at me. Because I'm not just going to be a shoulder to cry on. He's more than that. He is life. He is resurrection. He didn't just want to stop it at squeezing her and comforting her. He wanted to bring to life that which was dead. And that's who Jesus is. For Martha, Jesus speaks truth into her life in the midst of despair and grief. And some of us here today, Martha was in the need of it then. You must speak God's truth into the midst of your situation. We cannot allow grief and suffering to blind us to who Jesus is. You know, we all know what it's like when we have tears in our eye. You know, maybe we're driving down the road, listening to some Phil Collins or Chicago comes on, you know, whatever, and we're feeling emotional. You guys do that, right? I'll be watching one of the kids' movies, and Taylor looks over. She's like, are you crying? Like, babe, I'm emotional. But tears in our eyes, sometimes, you know what it's like. They can make the things of life blurry a little bit. But we can't forget this story. Jesus, This is crazy. Jesus allowed Lazarus to die and the two women he loved so much to wait so that he could reveal himself to his friends more intimately than ever before. They would know Jesus deeper because of the manner in which he was revealed through their suffering. So Jesus looks at Martha in verse 23 and says, "Your brother will rise again." He's going to put some truth into this situation. And then Martha says to him in response, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." You see, the afterlife wasn't as clear to those in the Old Testament as it was to us and to those in the New Testament. Sheol was this place that wasn't very defined, but you see, Martha shows that she was a student of the Word and in believing and understanding that Sheol wasn't the end of the road. You see, not everyone affirmed, even in Jesus' time, the hope of life and resurrection. The Sadducees, if you remember that group of guys, denied it because they didn't believe it was taught in the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch was the first five books in the Old Testament. But Jesus challenged the Sadducees in Matthew chapter 22, 29. He says, "You are wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God," both of which raise the dead things to life. He goes on to say in verse 31, "As for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? The clearest Old Testament passage about a future bodily resurrection is Daniel 12:2, and it says, "As many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt." You see, Martha's saying, "Yeah, Lord, I know the word. I believe it. I know that he's going to rise on that day. But right now, today, he's dead." And Jesus is like, "Oh, Martha, that's a limited view. Let me tell you exactly what's going on." Look in verse 25. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." You see, it wasn't what it seemed to be. The eyes of her literal physical eyes weren't seeing the whole picture. And some of you here today, you might be looking at a situation, but you don't see the whole picture. Jesus says, "Martha, actually, he's not dead because he believes. He's alive." And he's going to show her that. You see, in this statement, Christ declares that he is the resurrection and the life. There's two different things. And he goes on to explain in the very next verse, those that he explains separately and distinctly each clause of that sentence. Verse 26 says, "And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." That's resurrection. He takes what is dead and brings it to life. What was dead, Jesus resurrects. And then the next statement, he says, "Everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Not only does he take what was dead and bring it to life, he sustains that life through eternity and until we are in his presence. He says, "I reverse death. I conquer and hold power over the grave." There's nothing he can't do. And then Jesus makes it personal. He says, "Do you believe this? Do you believe this?" She had been in this vague doctrinal belief in a sense. And Jesus is like, "I'm going to bring this home." Right on her. And says, "Do you believe this?" Now think. This isn't coming up for prayer and praying with a pastor. This is God looking at you in one of the most emotional, roller coaster, desperate, grief-ridden moments in your eyes and saying, "Do you believe this?" And he's doing that to us today, too. He does it from that time on. He's doing it to us. He says, do you believe it? Do you believe that I can make dead things alive? Marriages that are stinky and rotten, relationships that are broken. Spiritually speaking, men and women, if you're sitting here today and you have not become a believer in Christ yet, do you believe that he can take a life that is dead to him and make it alive to him? Whereas there was like consternation or just absolute atheism and mocking, he can say, I'm going to make you alive. We've all heard Richard's testimony so many times. He was on a night, he was going to mock the people who were telling about Jesus. Yet Jesus brought something that was dead and made it alive. And he left that place loving Jesus. That's who Jesus is. He doesn't just give us life. He is life. He takes us from being dead and makes us alive. And it's not just spiritually speaking either. It's every aspect of your life. That unarming, gentle, authoritative, powerful look of Jesus going, do you believe this? Do you believe this? Do you believe that he will use grief and loss and suffering to draw you into himself so that you will know more about him? Jesus is asking you that this morning. Do you believe that I am the resurrection and life? And the way that he's going to get us to see that is to delay because of his love. Then we move to Mary in verses 28 and 29. When she, being Martha, had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling you. Mary's response, get up and go. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Mary comes when Jesus beckons. Mary needed to leave the place of comfort, sitting at her home in grief, perhaps on the ground or the stool, whatever the cultural or social context of that time had called for. That was her place of comfort. She wasn't an up and running one. But Jesus says, I want to see Mary. Who here this morning needs to see Jesus? He's calling you by name to say, I want to see you. And not just to comfort you, but to bring to life the areas that you feel are dead and dying. Jesus calls her to himself outside of her place of comfort so that he can teach her how much she needed him to give her life and how willing and able he was to do just that. There is nothing that could stop Jesus from showing Mary his power and his glory. Mary comes, verse 30, we'll pick it up in verse 30 here. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Again, that question, why did you let this happen? How come you didn't stop this? Verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Verse 36, so the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? Even the Jews, why didn't you stop this? Why did you let this happen? Everybody's questioning Jesus. I know that I have at times in my grief. It's normal to grieve in this manner. And in fact, Jesus uses death specifically to daily prove to us that we need life. Death reminds us we need life. Verse 38. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, take away the stone, Martha. He wasn't telling Martha to take away the stone. There's a period there. That's the result of 2 Red Bulls and 4 hours of sleep. or getting older. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." And Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Can you imagine that voice calling the dead to life right in front of you? Dave, first service, said it, and I had read it in my study time as well. They say that it's good that Jesus said Lazarus, otherwise everybody would have came forth. There would have been a party there right in that area. But this same voice is still calling people from spiritual death to life. He's still calling marriages to life. He's still calling friendships and relationships. Just when you think they're on the brink and 4 days rotten, completely decomposed, no hope, Jesus said, "I can make it come to life." But the question is, do you believe? He is resurrecting that which was dead to life. And to prove that to these two sisters that he had the power to resurrect life, he raises Lazarus and he literally comes out of the grave. And as dead as Lazarus was, is as dead as all mankind is spiritually without believing in Jesus Christ. And as sure as Lazarus was physically died, is as sure as you and I will die. Unless Jesus comes back, you're going to die, and so am I. Yet Christ takes these two absolute, inescapable realities about spiritual and physical death and crushes them as we see them. He puts them to shame with the power of his life over death. Job 19, 25 through 26 says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another." And to prove to you and to me that he has the power over death, that is the in the sense of resurrection, he's doing two things. He himself was resurrected from death to life, and he resurrects us from spiritual and physical death and gives us life. Before you and I see the end of God's plans worked out, will you put your trust in him? What situation do you need to do that with right now? Not just a vague doctrinal belief, but a personal belief that would prompt you to open up the tomb on whatever is the most unalive area of your life. Jesus allowed Lazarus to die. What has he allowed in your life to seemingly be dead? Do you see that without Christ, we're all dead? What area of your life do you need Jesus to make alive? For some of you, you need Christ to make you alive with him in a spiritual and eternal sense. Maybe you don't know Jesus as your Lord and Savior today. Will you put your trust in him? If you come to him, he will bring you in and give you life. He will give himself to you. John 6:37, Jesus says, "All that the Father gives to me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never cast out." For others, you need the resurrection and life that Jesus is in a different area of life. Perhaps like Martha and Mary, you know and love Jesus. But perhaps he has allowed death to come into your life literally or metaphorically. Perhaps it's a relationship or a promise that seems to have died. He brings those he loves through dark seasons so that he can put on display how fully and completely he brings dead things to life and then sustains that life to the end. There is nothing that he has raised that can die. Nothing. The wait for Christ to come, think of the sisters, the wait for Christ to come, and then the walk to the tomb, knowing that Lazarus was dead, it's all painful. That you can't take away the pain from that. You can't take away from the reality of that moment. This life will have painful moments of waiting and not seeing God's plan. But may I encourage you today, may I exhort you this morning to believe that Jesus is who he said he is, that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And no matter how you feel or how bleak the circumstances may seem, that you would believe him. The walk to the tomb wasn't to mourn the irreversible work of death. It was to witness the resurrection. Mary and Martha didn't know that. You might not know that right now. It's okay. Do you believe? That long walk to the tomb wasn't just for a bear hug. It was to see the truth about our Jesus, which is the fact that he is the resurrection and the life. Alexander McLaren, I'm going to call the worship team up. Alexander McLaren said this: "We should rejoice in the great light which has shined into the region of the shadow of death. We should clasp his divine and most faithful answer to that old despairing question as the anchor of our souls and lift up our hearts in thanksgiving in the triumphal challenge. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?" He has destroyed that. And he wants to reveal that to you and I. I'm going to close our time together with just reading a scripture from Colossians. Because this is true about our Jesus, and for those who are believers here, Colossians says, "If then you have been raised with Christ, resurrected, brought from death to life, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." Let's pray.